back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In June 2010, today's guest, Michael Hastings, wrote an explosive piece for Rolling Stone about General Stanley McChrystal, commander in Afghanistan at the time. The piece is called The Runaway General, and it focuses on the friction and disagreements between the general and the Obama administration, and quotes McChrystal and his aides making disparaging remarks about top administration officials. General McChrystal is accused of covering up the real cause of Pat Tillman's death in Afghanistan, the NFL star who was killed by friendly fire on April 22, 2004. McChrystal also pushed for 40,000 more troops in Afghanistan. Now, shortly after that piece ran in 2010, President Obama announced he was stripping General McChrystal of his command. He was forced to announce his retirement from the military after a 43-year career. Michael Hastings spent a total of 1 month with General McChrystal and his staff in places like Paris, Berlin, and Afghanistan. These interactions included sit-down interviews, dinners, and late-night conversations in bars. In his new book, The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan, Michael Hastings picks up where the Rolling Stone piece left off. In addition to writing about the military's distrust of President Obama, he elaborates on behind-the-scenes, very frank conversations between top military brass, and explores the relationship between the military and the press and conflicts of interest. The Pentagon has 27,000 people working on public relations, costing $4.7 billion a year. Michael Hastings is contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's covered the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Last year, he received the George Polk Award in Journalism for his Rolling Stone piece, The Runaway General. He's also author of I Lost My Love in Baghdad, A Modern War Story. It's a memoir about losing his fiance to a violent ambush in Iraq. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Love the show.
Well, thank you. And it's great to have you. On Fridays, we usually have a roundtable of guests, but we wanted to have you on your own because your book has so many interesting insights about what really goes on behind the scenes that we rarely hear about. But what we always do on Friday is ask reporters to talk about reporting that was done well this week. So you have a lot of criticism in your book about journalists, and we'll definitely talk about that. But where are you seeing actually good reporting on issues like Afghanistan?
Well, you know, actually, who should already be getting the Pulitzer Prize, a fellow by the name of Adam Goldman, who works for the Associated Press and has done this amazing series. If your listeners haven't checked it out, it's amazing, on the relationship between the CIA and the NYPD, a relation between the CIA and the NYPD over the last 10 years, and how the NYPD has essentially set up a domestic surveillance operation where they were spying on Muslims, Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims, who had done nothing wrong.
This is getting, I haven't been following this closely, but this is getting more attention this week.
Yeah, no, they broke a couple other big stories. The pressure is on the NYPD Police Commissioner Ray Kelly to resign. And I know that sounds a little bit like inside baseball to New York, but I think it really has national implications. And the reason it relates to sort of the, you know, you mentioned anything on Afghanistan, and there's great reporting on that as well. But I think what it gets at is this sort of massive national security state that we've seen grow over the last 10 years, and how even, you know, there's connections between the tremendous amount of money the Pentagon and the CIA has spent in Afghanistan and the tremendous amount of money they've spent kind of quote-unquote to protect the homeland. And we've seen this in this sort of very extensive domestic surveillance operation that it's honestly like not since the 60s have we seen such activity.
And we're actually next week doing a show about the militarization of police forces across the country.
Right. I mean, this is one of the most underreported big stories that's going to come down. And hopefully, if you're doing a story on it, I think obviously people are starting to pay attention to it, but just how a decade at war has affected America. Mm-hmm. And you know, people have said, oh, my book's about Afghanistan, and obviously that's the case, but in many ways it's a book about the United States and what's happened to us. And the group of men who ended up running this war after 10 years of conflict. So it's a book about Afghanistan, but half of it takes place in, like, the, you know, bars in Europe, and a quarter of it takes place in Washington, and only a quarter of it actually takes place probably on the ground there.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I got that from your book, and I was thinking back to the President Obama's State of the Union address, in which he began his speech with the military and ended his speech with the military. It almost came full circle, but I haven't read that many pieces really looking at that.
Well, what's interesting is that we're in a situation now where President Obama is forced in his State of the Union address to essentially spend the first 10 minutes genuflecting to the Pentagon and genuflecting to the military. Now, obviously, anyone who served deserves our gratitude and thanks. My younger brother was a Bronze Star winner in Iraq, a platoon leader. Some of my best friends have served. But I think it shows something about our political culture and just how militarized and how powerful the military has become that the president would dedicate the first 10 minutes to his speech, essentially just praising the military. And I think that has real profound implications, too, with how these things play out.
So in your book, you write that the Pentagon has about 27,000 people working on public relations, spending $4.7 billion each year. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's normal for each general to have his own personal media handlers, something numbering as many as half a dozen with an entourage to raise his profile in the press. And I had to laugh when you wrote about how you got such close access to General Stanley McChrystal and his aides, and it's because he wanted to be on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, the savviest general around is General David Petraeus, and he's now running the CIA. He's also retired from the military. But what he demonstrated over the past few years was that if you build up a fan base, so to speak, within the media, then you can easily bypass the normal chain of command. You essentially have your own sort of power base to push your own policies and ideas outside of the sort of traditional sort of chain of command structure. So General McChrystal had what I would call a case of Petraeus envy and tried to do the same thing. What's really incredible about even the fact that he did the interview with me was that the White House had warned him earlier not to do any more big interviews with anyone.
Well, and it wasn't just an interview. I mean, you traveled with these guys on and off for a month. You spent time in their hotel rooms. You went to dinner with them and their wives.
Right.
You hung out at bars when they were trashed.
Right.
I mean, they only asked you to go off the record twice.
Right, yeah, it was totally wild. You know, but this is who these guys are, right? The title of the book is The Operators, and that's from Special Forces Operators. And if you're a Navy SEAL or a guy like General McChrystal or any of these Green Beret types, I mean, you live off risk. If you're willing to jump out of an airplane at 30,000 feet, sneak into somebody's house and shoot him in the head, hanging out with a Rolling Stone reporter in Paris does not seem like that big of a deal. So just having me there, and so what their whole attitude towards having me around was, look, we're not going to tell you what to write. You do your thing. We're kind of this freewheeling operation. And they anticipated, I believe, a story that was like the previous stories that had been written about them, which was essentially, McChrystal is this sort of legendary hero, and he has great abilities at killing people, and he's going to win the war. Now, there's a lot of that I would agree about General McChrystal. I think actually that's reflected. A lot of people who read the book that actually we came away with a pretty favorable impression of both him and his team. And that's part of my point. Like, these are human beings, and try to get at the real character of them, not just mythologize them.
You were also shocked at the level of access that you were given.
Yeah. Yeah, the first conversation I had with Rolling Stone about this story, I remember it very clearly when I pitched the story to my editors there. And the editor said, well, how much access do you think you can get? I said, oh, not much. I've been very critical of the war and McChrystal himself, and, I doubt they're going to, give me much access. I said, I'll probably get an interview for a couple hours. They said, okay. And then, but then, it totally blew my mind when they said, come to Paris. And then after Paris, essentially, because of these sort of weird circumstances with this volcano and whatnot, ended up spending off and on for an entire month with them from Paris to Berlin. I had a little interlude in Dubai, and then went to Kabul, Kandahar, and back to Washington.
A lot of these guys told you that Iraq was not a good idea. In fact, General McChrystal told you, and I'll quote from your book, McChrystal tells me he didn't think Iraq was a good idea because the country didn't really pose a terrorist threat. These guys also talk to you about how they co-opt the media on a regular basis. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was one of the most amazing moment. With General McChrystal, there was a number of amazing moments. The first time I met him, he said he wanted to be on the cover of Rolling Stone. And I said, well, sir, it's between you and Lady Gaga. He said, well, just put me and Lady Gaga in a heart-shaped tub on the cover. And that was literally my first conversation I ever had with the man. So you know, there was this incredible interview on clearly I'm quite modest about my interviewing skills, but this sort of incredible interview, it was a Sunday in Paris. This was my day three, I think, I'd spent with them. And we were at this Mexican restaurant in the afternoon, you know, and I sort of started asking him all these in-depth questions about various issues, and I bring up Iraq. And he was the spokesperson. Now, General McChrystal at that time was one of the spokespeople for the Pentagon during the invasion. He said, we totally co-opted the military on that one. And then he lists all these journalists, all these famous journalists who'd written positive things about him, who they've co-opted. And I was like, oh, my God. What does it say about the state of American journalism that even, like, that the general who's just benefited from all this favorable coverage is even like, yeah, we really pulled one over on you guys that time. I've been in sort of a cold war with some of my friends in the Pentagon press corps recently. And I would say there are really great reporters there, except I don't want to name them because then they'd be found out. But generally, I think the Pentagon press corps and a number of the national security journalists who cover this stuff, their performance, you know, in recent years has been pretty poor.
You write, I rattled off a few names of journalists. I named the writer who just done the profile on McChrystal for The Atlantic, Robert Kaplan, quote, totally co-opted by the military, he said. I mentioned the journalist Tom Ricks, who'd written two best-selling accounts of the Iraq War. Screw Ricks, McChrystal said. Ricks, he said, was the kind of guy who'd stick a knife in your back. McChrystal's top press guy, Duncan, had also told me Ricks wasn't to be trusted. Thomas Ricks is one of the top foreign correspondents for The Washington Post. He was on this show a couple years ago. I understand that Thomas Ricks called your publisher in a fury, saying, do not publish this book.
Oh, yeah. So Tom Ricks had been... had left the Washington Post, and now he's a blogger at Foreign Policy Magazine. And what was interesting, yeah, exactly, this is what happened. When I called him for comment about what McChrystal had said, he flew, oh, my publisher's going to be very not happy that I'm telling this story right now. But he said, he called up and you know, said, why are you publishing this sort of thing? And the interesting thing about it, was that within minutes of me asking him for comment, he had already emailed General McChrystal and said, and got a comment right back from General McChrystal. It was this sort of very bizarre thing where, you know, within minutes he had emailed his buddy, this general, you know, who had emailed back, I can't recall saying that or something like that. But yeah, Ricks was very upset by that, and then he was also upset at me this week, and we got into this sort of Twitter thing. So it's been very strange. Look, The Gamble and Fiasco, I actually quite like those books. I think they're highly readable. I think they have a lot of great information there. My critique of Ricks is that he's just too close to the military, and that if he sort of told it like it is more than he did, I think we'd be better served.
Well, and also you write that he's on the payroll of the Center for a New American Security. Is he still on the payroll there?
Yes. Yeah, he is.
And so this is basically kind of a liberal hawkish think tank.
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, this is one of the great, I think, journalistic scandals that everyone seems to not be bothered by except me and a few others. Essentially, there's a think tank in Washington called the Center for a New American Security, and it's totally funded by defense contractors. And the people who are the fellows there are top generals, retired generals, and think tank guys who have a lot of influence sort of pushing policies. So what they do is they hire journalists, essentially. Tom Ricks is one of them. Robert Kaplan is one of them. The Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times has worked for them or been paid by them. Pentagon's correspondents for the Washington Post, same thing. And so essentially, you know, you have this very influential defense contracted funded, you know, think tank giving, you know, paying off the journalists who are covering them. And now they don't see it like that. They say, oh, no, you know, there's no corruption here. It doesn't affect our work. But essentially it's influencing, it's definitely influence peddling. And I would even say that, you know, look, if how are you going to, if the guy in the office next to you is writing and pushing these sort of military policies, and he's like your colleague, I mean, are you really going to, you know, be super critical of them? And the answer is no, they haven't been.
Well, and what's amazing is after your piece ran in the Rolling Stone magazine and McChrystal was forced to step down, I mean, you got slammed by these guys. The New York Times' John Burns said that your article has, quote, impacted and will impact so adversely on what had been pretty good military media relations. He accused you of violating a, quote, kind of trust, which reporters build up. Politico said that you would not, the Politico observed that a beat reporter, unlike the freelancing Michael Hastings, would not risk burning bridges by publishing many of McChrystal's remarks. Laura Logan, the overseas correspondent for CBS News, said, quote, Michael Hastings has never served his country the way McChrystal has. These top national reporters slammed you for revealing what goes on in conversations at bars.
Well, it wasn't just bars. I mean, the reality is most of the reporting in the book isn't even in bars. I mean, the fun stuff is, but all the comments about Obama and Biden and all this sort of stuff happened in sort of on-the-record briefings in front of staff members. I at first I was perplexed by the response from some of those folks you mentioned because I was like, oh, they just don't understand. So I sort of gave them the benefit of the doubt. But then it was sort of this sustained campaign. Because once everyone else moved on to it, these guys sort of, you know, kept at it, and to try to sort of undermine the credibility of Rolling Stone. And I guess, you know, what I would say about all of that is that, A, if you want to take it one by one with John Burns, who was the Baghdad bureau chief of the New York Times at one point. I mean, John Burns was one of the major cheerleaders in the New York Times for the Iraq War, right? Mm-hmm. This is someone who's complicit in pushing, you know, what was the most destructive foreign policy decision the United States, or one of the most destructive foreign policy decisions the United States has ever made. So you have that. And I think there's another thing with Burns, which is that I don't know how familiar you are with the work of William S. Burroughs, but Burns has always reminded me of the sort of William S. Burroughs of foreign correspondence, one of these sort of war junkies, but instead of like needing dope to sort of stay alive, he needs war. You know, so he's always in these places doing these things. And then you have, someone, I forget who else, Politico. Politico, it's like the summer camp newsletter for, you know, inside the Beltway nonsense. I mean, that's what they do. They sort of pretend like they're giving you the inside scoop, but it's just kind of nonsense. And then with Lara, I thought those comments were unfortunate, and I think, I just think it's unfortunate. I don't think, you know, questioning someone's, you know, ability to criticize the military based on where they serve. It might be politically effective, but I just don't think it's that honest.
We're speaking with Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. You might remember that 2 years ago, Michael's explosive piece in Rolling Stone led to the resignation of General Stanley McChrystal. He was the top commander in Afghanistan. He had to step down after a 43-year career. And we're speaking with Michael about his book, about the close relationship between the military and the press. And we'll talk also about what goes on behind the scenes, the distrust between the military and the administration. And if you have any questions for Michael, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of Iraq and Afghanistan 11 years on? 866-798-8255. This is our Friday Media Roundtable. We wanted to have Michael on solo today because there's so much information about this book that we wanted to discuss. And if you've got any stories that you'd like to talk about, as usual, feel free to call in at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for this opportunity. Let me say at the outset that this country needs our military. I am pro-military. I was a Marine. But let me also say our military can be abused. Right before the war in Iraq started, there were a lot of stories written against the war, but they never saw the light of day. Were many stories that were pro-war, coming in all kinds of press area, were given the light of day. Now, I didn't just come up with this. This was on Bill Moore's show. He mentioned that, like, only a very small percentage of stories against the war were getting into the press. The real problem with the press today is that they think embedding is a good idea. It's not a good idea. You don't want to install reporters with military units. They become part of that unit. They depend on their lives from that unit. So their stories are more favorable of what those units are doing. And it puts it in a situation where the people in the home front cannot get a grasp of what's going on. I knew the war in Iraq was a mistake before the war in Iraq started. I was on numerous shows trying to stop it. I was kicked off so many shows. National Public Radio. I said this country was conned into a war to two American generals, Army generals. Right after that, I mentioned to you this before, Rose, I was not allowed to go back on public radio. So it's...
I think about Phil Donahue at MSNBC, sure, and the leaked memo that said he had to have, you know, three pro-war voices to every one anti. This has been going on for years.
And you, Roger, thank you for your question. Also, thank you for your service. As a Marine, I agree. I mean, I don't think anyone is arguing that, we shouldn't have a military. The question is, as you said, you know, is the military being abused? And I think, you know, the answer is yes, and I think the people on top of the military are willing participants in that abuse. That to me is the sort of the tragedy of it all, and one of the things I try to highlight. Also, in terms of embedding, if you know Roger was not allowed back on air for some of his views. I have the distinction of being, I think, the only journalist who's sort of permanently banned from going on embeds now. So I got a letter after my story saying that I was no longer welcome to go on embeds, even though other journalists had given away sort of sensitive troop information, but they're allowed back. But because of what I reported, I'm no longer welcome.
Well, what about your access to the Pentagon? Because in your book, I mean, you name names here. All of McChrystal's aides, a lot of these guys have resigned as a result.
Well, actually, a lot of them, this is this what's interesting, most of them actually didn't resign. Colonel Charlie Flynn, who was the executive officer who I write about and have a sort of the scene of him in the Berlin Ritz, you know, trying to talk to this sort of woman they think is a spy or a prostitute. He's now one of the top generals out in Fort Leavenworth.
McChrystal's top aide, Duncan, he resigned, right?
Yeah, okay. He resigned. Yeah, exactly. But basically, except for Duncan and McChrystal, they protected the rest of them and promoted them and put them into influential positions within the Pentagon.
And how are your Pentagon interview requests received now?
Yeah, they're not. Going through the official channels doesn't necessarily work for me these days. But look, my relationship with the White House, State Department, and a lot of people, the Pentagon's a huge organization with a lot of different viewpoints, and people will still. I mean, I get calls from people all the time who have stories and things to say. I would say it's all pretty positive. I mean, it hasn't really made much of an impact on my reporting or my life much at all.
We're speaking with Michael Hastings about his new book, The Operators. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking media coverage of the military, Iraq, Afghanistan. What are your thoughts? Where are you seeing good reporting? You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're tuned to KALW San Francisco. Our email newsletter is a great way to keep up to date with local public radio as well as the latest developments in non-commercial media. We won't jam your inbox, but every week or two you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events as well as the occasional free ticket offer. It's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link at kalw.org, and thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station.
This is Your Call. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can leave a comment there. You can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll talk about what's in store for the future of Nigeria. Religious violence has cost 500 lives. The recent removal of subsidies has led to major political unrest. So we'll talk about who's benefiting from Nigeria's natural resources. We're also putting shows together next week about private equity firms, the militarization of police departments, and banned books in Arizona. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're speaking with journalist Michael Hastings about his new book, The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. 2 years ago, Michael's piece for Rolling Stone led to the resignation of General Stanley McChrystal, the top commander in Afghanistan. He was forced to step down after 43 years in the military after Michael revealed friction between the military and the administration, and also wrote about comments made by McChrystal and his top staff about people like Joe Biden and President Obama. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about coverage of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military. What are your thoughts on that? And then, as always, on Friday, if there was a story you saw that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. You can actually be good if you could post that story at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And just quickly, before we get to calls, Michael, can you talk about what you learned about the friction between the top military brass and the Obama administration? You said it was pretty deep a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Does that still exist?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. It's fascinating how that's evolved. I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, the Pentagon people were so angry with me is because because Rolling Stone was right. I mean, you know, we were one of the first to report in that story extensively on this sort of really dysfunctional relationship between the top military brass and the White House, which was then, you know, reconfirmed in Bob Woodward's book that came out. And even in the most recent, you know, biography of General Petraeus that was written, you know, gets into these sort of very serious tensions. So what was it about, right? It's about a young president, young Democratic president named Barack Obama, being inaugurated and never having served, and being someone who was viewed as a anti-war guy because he was against the war in Iraq. And remember, you know, the last three secretaries of defense before Panetta were Republicans. The Pentagon was, you know, filled up to the gills in the bureaucracy with Republicans. You know, the Pentagon was hostile territory for a young President Obama. And, you know, so, and they took advantage of that, essentially. You know, they said, President Obama said, I don't want a plan for 10 years of nation building in Afghanistan. And the Pentagon came back and said, here's, you know, Petraeus and McChrystal said, here's our plan for a 10-year nation-building campaign in Afghanistan. And instead of following orders, they waged this media campaign to pressure the president into giving them the 40,000 troops that they wanted.
And you write that they thought Obama was not comfortable with the military and he was intimidated by the military. They were angry because at times he would meet maybe twice a year with these top generals. When he would go over to Baghdad or Kabul, he would spend only a half hour, wouldn't really take many photos.
Right. There was sort of a cultural clash there, too, and I think it's actually quite significant. You know, President Obama was obviously one of the most talented politicians the country's ever seen, but his comfort level with the military, at first, at least as it was described to me, was not there. I have this scene now. I had seen this upset some people in Washington. You know, where President Obama visits Baghdad for the, I think, his second time in 2008 when he was campaigning, and he sort of started complaining about having to take pictures with troops and diplomats, which is something you just don't do. You just don't say it, even if you're thinking that, even if you're tired and stressed out. You know, you don't say that to guys, you know, who are actually there in Baghdad. So you know, I think there was this sort of cultural clash. And look, we see it, you know, it's kind of like doth protest too much. I mean, you mentioned that State of Union address, how much it has to be about how much they love the troops.
Right.
It's like, you know, why? Why do you have to keep reminding us of that?
Well, even though there are two explosive documentaries out right now, one about water contamination at Camp Lejeune, and the government has done nothing about it, and another one about systemic rape in the military.
Yeah. No, there's, you know, this is what is disturbing to me. You know, the great military historian Paul Fussell, whose name I always mispronounce, was asked about the Greatest Generation. He was being asked about World War II. And what he said was, I'm going to paraphrase here and paraphrase badly, but he said, look, there are a bunch of drunks, thieves, and losers in the Greatest Generation as well. Hmm. And what he meant by that is, I think, I don't know if we're doing anyone favors by pretending everyone is a hero. You know, there are a lot of heroes, but should we really pretend that it's this sort of untouchable institution? I think just is a recipe for gross abuse. I mean, you mentioned the rapes. There was this horrible incident recently at Dover Air Force Base, where they were flying the remains of soldiers in. You heard these horrible things, cutting people's legs off, throwing remains in the dumpster, all this sort of stuff. You go down the line of the sort of these crazy abuses that come out, and how does that square with this sort of romanticized, idealized version of the military can do no wrong? And again, because I say this, you'll say, oh, you're anti-military, and that's not actually the case. It's just I prefer just to look at it sort of realistically.
We have an email from Daniel who says, we need more outlets like yours and Rolling Stone. I was infuriated by the coverage of the lead-up to and events of the war. Hearing Mr. Hastings describe how the military was co-opting the media with ease drives my blood pressure up even more. The news service in the country died with Edward M. and for-profit news. Thank you. You give me hope for a better tomorrow. Thanks for the email, Daniel. And let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Something very familiar happening, which is the drumbeat of war against Iran by both the United States and Israel. And the fact is, I'd like to ask your guest if you ever watched that great BBC production, The Power of Nightmares, because it explains the whole thing. The new conservative movement marriage with the military-industrial complex and the takeover of the United States, not just foreign policy, but foreign and economic and everything, to use the American people, American economy, to just have world domination over the whole Middle East and all over the world. And the fact is, Obama is really still under the control. And if you look at the new conservatives, people like Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feist and many, Ari Frasher, and these people, you see them very frequently on TV promoting the sport, especially with the Republican candidates. Nobody knows anything about it because they're just in their pocket.
Well, thank you, Ede. What are your thoughts on reporting on Iran?
Well, Ede nailed it. This is the Afghanistan and Iraq are fading into the rear view. Mm. Iran is the major foreign policy question that is going to be the key issue in this campaign and possibly in the next few years. I'm not familiar with that documentary, but you know, one thing about the neoconservatives, it's like, you know, it's hard to be more wrong more often than the neoconservatives, yet they still all have these high-paying jobs. So that's always been a little perplexing to me. The fact that they haven't all been dragged out into the street and publicly shamed by this point is quite extraordinary. But I think with Iran, here's what's happening, and again, your guest nailed it. You have this, the leaks are starting. Oh, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, Iran and Al-Qaeda are linked. You know, there was a report the other day that came out that said Al-Qaeda is now in Iran. And then another report saying, oh, well, Iran wants to attack the United States on its own soil. And then, you know, you have that incident with the drone where we're flying drones over Iran and we lost one of them. So you have this sort of groundwork is being softened to go to war with Iran. And what we've seen is the discourse shift, right? Remember, President Obama came into office saying he was going to negotiate with Iran. And so the argument the discussion at that point was between negotiation and sanctions. Now, then it sort of shifted to sanctions and do we need to get tougher than sanctions? And now, literally, we're seeing the debate shift to, what kind of military option are we going to use? And that to me, is frightening. And the problem is, especially during this election, the Republicans are just moving this dialogue so far towards the pro-war side that it's going to have lasting impact, and it could you could end up in a situation. I was speaking to my administration sources recently, and they said, look, the Obama administration does not want to go to war with Iran. The Republicans seem like they actually do. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, what could happen is some kind of fluke incident that just sort of, you know, tripwire something and it just escalates into a war. That's the most likely scenario that they, that the Obama people are worried about.
And Al-Qaeda is being brought back into the conversation. In your book, you write that Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had to remind McChrystal and Petraeus that they need to include more Al-Qaeda in their message to sell the war.
Yeah, no, it's totally strange to see this happening again and not have every... How these journalists are writing these stories with straight faces. And I know I'm being tough on my colleagues, and I'm sorry, God bless them. I know they're trying. But it, you know, how they're writing these stories about, you know, Al-Qaeda linked to Tehran and this and that with straight faces without sort of saying, like, all these claims have been proven false in the past. You know? It's I remember being – I was an intern at Newsweek. Here's some inside – We go up into the Internet Wayback Machine. I started as an Internet Newsweek magazine in 2002, right? So I sort of watched the run-up to the Iraq War from the inside, sitting in these editorial meetings. And it was interesting. One by one, you saw people whose entire body of work would have suggested they'd be against the war flip to being pro-war. And I remember editing, you know, I was like 22, 23, editing a story that said, you know, Al-Qaeda's in Baghdad. You know, I mean, literally, in Newsweek magazine, intelligence officials say Al-Qaeda's in Baghdad. Totally false. No one's ever been held to account for any of it.
We're speaking with Michael Hastings, author of The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. At the ripe age of, what, you were in your late 20s when this Rolling Stone article came out that brought General Stanley McChrystal down.
I was.
You were 29.
I think I was 30.
30.
I think I was 30. So.
And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about media coverage of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military. 866-798-8255. Michael writes about many top national reporters working for these hawkish think tanks, being paid by these think tanks, and writing for the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. 866-798-8255. What will it take to get beyond the spin? The Pentagon has 27,000 people working on public relations, costing almost $5 billion a year. Where are you seeing good coverage of what's happening? And then, as always, if there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. We have just over 10 minutes left. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan.
Hello, thank you. And I'm enjoying your recent interview with Julian Assange in the most recent Rolling Stone magazine. And I would like Mr. Hastings to comment on what his extradition to Sweden might. I think that the trial is going on this week, and
right,
what that might, you know, infer for journalists, especially people like Seymour Hersh or maybe even yourself who are using the information from these cables. And as far as Afghanistan, as somebody who has traveled to Baluchistan, I think it's so important to see that area as its own entity. I was very appreciative of a person on your program. I think his name is Kaveh Afsani,
right,
a professor at DePaul University, International Studies. And he was talking, even though Baluchistan is technically speaking, in Pakistan, it's really its own entity. Quetta is very Baluchi and even Afghani in character, as well as Peshawar up north in the northeast frontier provinces. And I'd love to see a focus more on the humanitarian crisis of Afghanistan, the poverty, even the polio vaccination being, you know, showing up, the illiteracy rate and the malnutrition that is traveling from Baluchistan up to the northeast frontier province and even through Jammu and Kashmir to the very north of Pakistan, where the borders between India and China are disputed. So polio is now showing up in China, for heaven's sakes, through this transportation corridor that I traveled through in a more peaceful time. And so I think way too much emphasis is given right now in this area to... Is this terrorist activity?
Okay. Susan, sorry to cut you off. Let's get a response because we're almost out of time.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for reading the Julian Assange interview. I spent Julian Assange, who's the founder of WikiLeaks, has been under house arrest for the past year in England. I spent about 3 days with him before Christmas a couple of weeks ago, while he was sort of monitoring the trial of Bradley Manning, who was the alleged leak of the WikiLeaks documents, or one of some of the little WikiLeaks documents. And he was also waiting for this, as the caller said, Susan said, to see if he was going to get extradited to Sweden. Now, I was just thinking about this last night. What was going on with Julian? If he loses this last appeal, he will be extradited to Sweden within 10 days, and where he'll have to face these allegations of sexual misconduct. If he wins, it's unclear what's going to happen with him. He will no longer be under house arrest, I don't think. But there's still going to be an Interpol arrest warrant out for him. So I think he's in a tough legal situation regardless. I think he's either going to be stuck in England until, for years. Not necessarily under house arrest, but just not allowed to travel out of the country. Or he's going to have to go back and face these allegations in Sweden and just try to get it behind him. His fear about going back to face the allegations is that he will then be extradited to the United States and be prosecuted on espionage charges, which the U.S. government is pursuing against WikiLeaks. And this is the great outrage, as Susan mentioned, in terms of what WikiLeaks did is just a more it's just more of what, Cy Hirsch and Bob Woodward do all the time. So that to me is very, very disturbing, and why I wanted to go over and talk to Assange and sort of get his view on a lot of these things. Even though there's a lot of flaws with the guy, he's also done a lot of, I think, very positive things for journalism. Baluchistan, I think anytime you hear foreign policy people start talking about these regions of the world and this sort of big think global power talk, I'm very suspicious of it. Like, I'm no expert on a lot of these places, but I know they're quite different. And when we try to sort of fit it into our Western lens of the war on terror, we're liable to make some pretty grave mistakes. It's the same thing we did in Vietnam, where we saw Vietnam as this larger Cold War struggle, when in fact the appropriate way to view it would have been as a very local sort of civil war.
And just quickly, Julian Assange just got a gig with Russia Today, the TV station funded by the Russian government. We're going to actually look at RT on a future Friday show. But do you have any overall thoughts about that? I mean, RT does not, when they cover the uprising in Russia, they spend more time covering the so-called support for the Russian government, for example.
Yeah, look, I've been on RT recently a couple times, and there in RT America, there's a couple shows. There's one show I actually quite like, and I'm friends with some of those people. But it's very clear, like, Jesus, they should be more critical of Putin. And if they're not, they're going to lose total credibility. So I think that's clearly a real issue. For Assange to do it, if I was advising him on the media, I would suggest not taking money from the Russian government at this stage in his career. But he doesn't, he's short on cash, probably needs the money. I think he's playing a dangerous game when he starts getting involved in this sort of thing and taking money from any of these governments. I don't think it helps him. I doubt having a program is going to, be a net positive. To be totally blunt, as someone who supported WikiLeaks publicly, and I actually, enjoyed spending time with Assange, I think it's a bad move.
Hmm. Well, we're definitely going to look into this in the coming weeks. Thank you for the call. Let's go next to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wish somebody would do a really, in Watergate, there was a line which said, follow the money.
Mm.
And over the last 10 years or more, we have heard periodically about billions and billions and trillions of dollars that have magically disappeared in the Pentagon, in foreign aid, in Iraq in particular. And yet no reporter has yet seen a fit to focus on that like a laser beam, probably because he'll end up dead. But where did the money go?
That's an amazing question. And there are reporters who've done incredible investigative work on that, but the problem is it just doesn't get the attention, mm-hmm. I mean, look, the reason my story got attention wasn't because it was a devastating critique of our failed policy that was leading to the deaths of thousands of people. It was because General McChrystal, one of General McChrystal's top advisors called you know, made fun of Vice President Biden.
Right.
Right.
Because that's what got the most attention.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you know, so as your caller suggested, yeah, I mean, the money, oh, my God. I mean, you know, a lot of people have gotten rich off this war, and it's not me, and it's not you, and it's not the caller.
You know, but Michael, what's so interesting is those of us who don't have close connections to the military, we tend to focus on the billions, like Raul said. But what I got from your book, and we don't spend much time talking about this, is the obsession with war.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys barely spend time with their wives. And they spend so much time overseas. This is what they live, breathe, and think about is war. And that doesn't really get much attention.
No. And it's why I got along with them, too, because this has been my life for years now. This sort of, you know, you're totally immersed in this bizarre world where the stakes are higher than they've ever been, and they'll never be as high again. You know, when you're in Kabul or Baghdad, you know, your life is on the line and lives of other people are on the line, and it's this sort of intoxication with power that comes with it, so you have to look at what kind of mentality do the people possess who enjoy doing this. You know, the big joke, the funniest thing about General McChrystal, or one of them, was that he hated being in Paris. He would have rather been in Kabul than in Paris. That's not a decision most people would make. It's a decision, you know, I might make, but I'm a nut, you know? So, you know, and so these guys are, and that's why, I mean, I get back to this again and again, and when I call them maniacs, I'm not being that hyperbolic. I mean, they have a certain predisposition and obsession with war and killing that I think is very, to me, you know, needs to be looked at more.
And there aren't many women involved in any of these decisions, right? I mean, you wrote about, I think there were maybe two women, other than the wives, two women in your entire book about how hard it is for women reporters to get access.
Right, right. I mean, and one of the women that I write about at length is this woman they think is a spy or a prostitute. But yeah, for General McChrystal and the team, it was the boy. I mean, it was a real boys club. It was the frat boys, like a bunch of white dudes. You know.
Yeah, and you also write about rampant sexism and racism and homophobia.
Oh, yeah.
What about what we're reading right now in the news that Leon Panetta is signaling an end to combat in Afghanistan? I mean, what do you make of the news on Afghanistan that we're getting in the last couple of days?
This is what I've been saying. I mean, I think this is President Obama, after being burned the first year in office by the Pentagon, has then taken steps to retake control over his strategy. And what when President Obama says the tide of war is receding, I think that's actually correct. I think he really means it. And the war is essentially over. You know, I've been saying this now for the last and I write this in the book. Essentially, the war in Afghanistan is over. It's just a matter of wrapping it up. And the tragedy is that they're still going to be fighting for a couple more years, and hundreds of more Americans and thousands of more Afghans are going to die before it comes to a conclusion. But as far as the U.S. is concerned, it's done. I mean, it's turn out the lights, you know, last one out, you know, make sure the door doesn't hit you on the way out.
Well, we have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Nate in Los Gatos. Hi, Nate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm generally sympathetic to, the positions your guests are taking, although a couple of places where I think you might be pushing the point too far. First off, with respect to Iran, he kind of characterized that as, we're getting closer to Iran because of some drumbeat from Republicans or neoconservatives. But I mean, let's remember there's two to tango. I mean, I think Iran's behavior over the last few years plays some very significant role in the worsening of relations. And as kind of a third-party data point, I mean, even the Europeans are taking a much tougher line with Iran than they had in the past. I think that part of this problem really is what Iran is doing, and that they seem, focused on getting, nuclear capability and regardless of negotiations. My second point has to do with the idea of embedding. I totally take your point about the idea that if you're embedded, it's hard to be objective. And so maybe there, you always need a reporter like your guest who's on the outside. But on the other hand, if you don't embed, then you can't get those just sort of day in the life, what is it like for the soldiers on a daily basis story. Because you can get that in the green zone, but, for people who are dropping into some random valley in the middle of Afghanistan, they're just not going to be able to get that story. So I guess for policy decisions, embedding is bad, but to really know what life on the ground is like, I don't see any alternative in some circumstances.
No, and I just quickly, I would agree with your caller actually on both of those points. You know, look, the Iranian regime are a bunch of real SOBs who have not, you know, so I'm not defending them at all and the activities that they've undertaken. I'm just sort of suggesting that, look, we have, you know, 150, we had up until recently 120,000 troops to the west of Iran in Iraq, and then we have another occupying army to the west of to the west of Iran. So we've essentially surrounded Iran, you know, and their response has been to sort of wage sort of this low, you know, intensity guerrilla campaign against our interest, quote unquote interest, in Afghanistan and Iraq. Look, they're pursuing a nuclear weapon, and that's, you know, I wish, you know, they wouldn't do that. But from their perspective, any country that has a nuclear weapon is safe. You know, I mean, Pakistan, North Korea, the countries that didn't have nuclear weapons, Libya, which gave up the nuclear weapons, and Iraq, which didn't have a nuclear weapon, you know, got toppled. Afghanistan as well. So it's from a just sort of a national, from just sort of a kind of big think foreign policy perspective, the pursuit of a nuclear weapon for Iran makes perfect logical and rational sense. And with the embed thing, I think you're right. I probably did go a little. Some of the most formative experience I've had in my life have been on embeds, and my understanding, as limited as it might be, of the military is from going on embeds. So I'm not a hardline person who thinks like, there's no value in embeds. I think there's tremendous value in doing embeds, but it does get to a point where you can lose your objectivity pretty easily.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Michael, but we'd love to have you on a future Friday media roundtable.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
A great show, and thanks for all the callers, too.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Michael Hastings is author of The Operators, The Wild and Terrifying Inside Story of America's War in Afghanistan. It's your call. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What's in store for the future of Nigeria? On the next Jor Call, we'll have a conversation about Africa's most populous nation and its largest oil producer. Religious violence cost 500 lives last year, and the recent removal of subsidies has led to political unrest. So what explains the rise of religious extremism in Nigeria? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Who's benefiting from Nigeria's natural resources? It's Jor Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
While too much of the country would be distracted by our Super Bowl preparations, we will continue to move the ball down the field when it comes to talking about the poverty crisis in America.
Join us next week and every week as we put a spotlight on the needs of poor and working Americans.
Next time on Smiley and West.
From PRI.
Smiley and West coming up at 1 o'clock here on your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. Coming up next, it's BBC World Service and World Have Your Say, followed by the Tavis Smiley Show at noon, and then Smiley and West at 1 o'clock, followed by the BBC's NewsHour at 2. This is KALW, San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Jill McGivering. Welcome to World Have Your Say. And the spotlight is still on Egypt.
What I can also see is clouds of tear gas going up and some protesters heading towards them, fighting their way through the tear gas to throw stones and other missiles.
Clashes erupt again in Tahrir Square. Protesters are angry about the deaths on Wednesday of football fans. They accuse the police of failing to stop the violence. Many are also angry with the ruling military council. They say it's mismanaging the transition to democracy. What's happened to Egypt's revolution? And if you're accused of a crime, should you lose your job, even if you insist you're innocent? Footballer John Terry is removed as England captain after allegations of racially abusing another player. He denies the charges. Is that fair? Call us on Country Code 44 20 70 83 72 72.